Welcome to Trilawyer Talk. I'm Scott Glowski, and I'm your host for this podcast. We're going to talk to some of the best trial lawyers in the United States. We're going to talk to civil lawyers, criminal lawyers, jury consultants, and others that I think will have some interesting stories that are both entertaining and insightful. My goal here is to give you a view inside the hearts and the minds and the souls of great trial lawyers. We're not going to talk about the law, but I guarantee you that you'll learn a lot about trial through the stories that you're going to hear from our great guests. So I hope you enjoy the podcast. Let's get started. We're very fortunate with us today is Ron Estefan, who's one of the most real, genuine, and authentic trial lawyers that I know. And Ron's from Texas and does tremendously great work in Texas and helps lawyers around the country and teaching other lawyers how to try cases and how to be real. Ron, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Scott. You're welcome, and thank you for asking me to do this. And I'm humbled by the kind words you have to say about me. I appreciate that very much. Thank you.
Ron, can you tell me a story about a case that profoundly changed you, either personally or professionally?
I'm happy to. So I met Linda in around 2008. Linda was a mother of twin boys. One of her sons, Matthew, was profoundly retarded and profoundly autistic and had to be cared for in a home, because Linda could no longer take care of him anymore. He's now was 23 years old, so he's a grown man. And Linda finally had to put him in an assisted living facility for people that specialized, for homes that specialized in dealing with people with Matthew's issues. Well, he got kicked out of that home. And so Linda had to, and one of the things about people with profound autism and profound mental challenges is that they are apt to lose their temper. Because they can't communicate the way that you and I can. They don't have all the tools in their tool bag that you and I have. So they use outbursts and emotions when they get frustrated, which is sometimes frequently. Linda went and shopped for another home for Matthew to live in. That's another assisted living facility. And she went to many until she found one. And I mean, each one she would go in, she would see how clean it was, and she would smell to see if the place had smelled sanitary. And she would look on the wall and see all the certificates and the plaques and awards and all the training certifications that these people had, you know. So after having done that for I don't know how many weeks and months she did, she settled on one home in particular. And this assisted living facility was a home, just a regular house, that was converted to an assisted living facility. And right next to that house was another house where the owners of the home lived. So they lived next door to the assisted living facility, and they had themselves a grown son, and their son was a college scholarship basketball athlete. He was a large kid. He was also in the business with the parents. So on one particular day, Matthew had been living in the home for a while. Matthew was having an outburst, and nobody was there to manage him except one, like kind of a housekeeper woman. So she calls the owners of the home who live next door and said, "I need help." They send their son over, and their son restrains Matthew. But the way he does it is he lays on top of Matthew, and as he does so, Matthew is face down on the ground with his left arm under him and his full body weight pushing down on top of him, and then the neighbor's son's full body weight on top of Matthew. And Matthew dies. He asphyxiates, dies. And Linda, as you might imagine, went to pieces, really lost it, and blamed herself for having put him in this home. And we worked with Linda on her case before we went to trial. And it was profound, the work that we did, the stuff that we learned. And so we're in trial.
Can you talk for a moment about the profound things that you learned?
Yeah, it was apparent to me when we started doing the work that we do to discover the story in depth and discover where the emotional core of the story is. As we would reenact the scenes of Linda being told that her son had died and things like that, and how she responded in that moment, it was apparent to me that Linda was either giving me a rehearsed response or she was under some sort of medication. And I wasn't sure which, because it was flat. Her response was flat. And so we worked all morning, and at noon we took a break for lunch. And Linda comes up to me and says, "I think this is going great. I really like you. Do you like me?" And I said, "Linda, I do not like you." Which was not an easy thing for me to say, because I generally like people and I genuinely like and love my clients. But I said to Linda, "Do you want to know why I don't like you, Linda?" And she said, "Please tell me." And I said, "Because you're not giving me anything to like. I'm seeing some two-dimensional version of you. Something's missing. I don't know what it is, but I'm not seeing any feeling, any genuine emotion from you." Well, we had lunch, and after lunch was a completely different Linda for the afternoon session. And the room felt it. There were 10, 12 people in there helping, and the dynamic was different. I mean, Linda really let it all hang out. I mean, how much she felt guilt and shame for putting her son in that place, and how she never should have done that, and how she, you know, can't celebrate Mother's Day anymore because she feels guilty because the one son, the twin, lived and the other one died, and she feels like she just can't celebrate Mother's Day anymore and their birthday. They were, of course, born on the same day, so she's still got a living son, but she felt like it's almost cheating on the dead son to celebrate the living son's birthday. We found out all those sorts of things as we did the work. So at trial, Linda was on the stand, and I'm asking her questions. And one of the things that happened in the trial was that I asked Linda, how did it feel when you found out your son had died? And she looked at me and said, "What do you mean, how did it feel?" And I said, "I meant, how did it feel?" And she just looked at me with a glaring look on her face and just froze up. And she didn't answer. Judge took a break. Linda and I had a little meeting during the break, after which trial resumed. And I said, "Linda, when we took a break, I had asked you how it felt." And she said, "Ron, I apologize to you. I just froze up and I don't know why. It's really, I don't have a good explanation. It's just painful for me to think about the memory of my son and all that happened." And so we went through her examination, and it obviously went much better than it went before the break. Well, come closing argument time, I start my closing argument on the floor, laying on the floor of the well of the courtroom, the way that Matthew was laying when he was killed. And my words to the jury to begin the closing argument were, "No donut for you." Those were the words that Matthew said when he was alive to relate to someone that he knew he had been bad and that he was being punished. That was Matthew's way of saying, "I get it. I know I did something wrong. No donut for you," because his grandmother used to tell him when he was a little boy, whenever he did something wrong, "No donut for you." So his way of saying, "I understand, I'm bad," is "no donut for you." And so I started off the closing argument laying there. The jury all stood up and was looking over the rail, watching me. And I said, "No donut for you." And I stood up and I said, those were likely the last words Matthew Vick ever said on this earth. And I went through my closing argument, and at some point I turned to Linda, who was sitting at counsel table. I turned away from the jury and turned to Linda. And I said, "Linda, 2 days ago, during your testimony, you apologized to me. And I need to tell you that I apologize to you for having opened old wounds and gone into painful places, and I'm sorry I had to do that. Will you accept my apology?" And she just bowed her head and acknowledged it, and I took that as an acceptance, and I went back to the jury, and I'm talking with the jury, and we asked the jury for a lot of money in that case, in a very conservative county in Texas. And, you know, keep in mind, Matthew was not a wage earner and was never going to be. So we didn't have an economic model. We just had, what we had was the loss of a mother's love and affection of one of her children, adult children. That's what we were asking the jury to compensate Linda for. So the jury goes to deliberate and they come back and they awarded Linda $1.5 million. And the most remarkable thing happened after that. The jurors came out from around the jury box and they all went over to Linda and they hugged her. And then the jurors went over to the defendants who own the home and they hugged them. And it was in that moment that I recognized how powerful and how career-changing that case was and the methods were. And I hope I've answered your question, because you asked if there was a case that let me know that changed my career.
Ron, that story is so powerful and frankly painful. How do you deal with that in working on a case like that and having such a huge responsibility to help someone whose life has been damaged so deeply?
Well, the only way I can answer that is to say, how can I not deal with it? You know, I can't have any meaningful connection with a jury unless I'm feeling it too. And so I guess the easy way out would have been just to hear from Linda tell me the facts and then make it up and tell the jury, "Hey, these folks killed her son, give her a lot of money." But that didn't have the emotional impact on me. And in turn, I would not have been able to deliver that emotional connection to the jury. So how do I deal with it? I deal with it because I know I have to deal with it. I have to form that connection because I can't ask the jury to connect with my client if they see that I can't even connect with my client. I would feel like a fraud standing in front of that jury telling them how terrible this thing was if I didn't actually experience it, you know. And I'll tell you this. This is another little side note that nobody ever knew about. This is the first time anybody's hearing about it. The night before closing argument, I couldn't sleep. And I was up about 2:30 in the morning. And I was walking around the house. And I sat on the sofa and I crossed my arms and I was sitting there and I was thinking about how I was going to make my closing argument to this jury. And all I could think about was my own children. And how I would be feeling if one of my children had been taken from me that way, had been killed. And then the closing argument was easy.
How did you feel after you saw the jury hug your client, hug the defendant?
I felt as close to the kind of surreal Atticus Finch moment. And I know that To Kill a Mockingbird was a different outcome for Atticus and his client. And there was no hugging by the jury of anybody. But it felt like the reason that I became a lawyer. I mean, if anybody had ever said to me ahead of time, you can try a case so well that the jury can actually award your client a lot of money and still love both her and the defendant, the people she sued.
But Ron, frankly, I'm not understanding. What led the jury to hug the defendant?
You need a little more backstory, and I'll give that to you. The defendants were a very nice couple from Africa. I had to cross-examine the wife, one of the co-owners of the home. In the process of examining her, she immediately broke down and started bawling on the stand, and then told the jury that she was completely devastated by Matthew's death because she cared for him very much. But then she shared that her own son, the college athlete on scholarship, had been shot and killed a year before trial. And so it was clear to the jury that she and her husband had suffered loss too, not just Matthew's death, but their own child's death. And they didn't view making an award for Linda as something that was harmful or detrimental to the folks who own the defendants in this case, the folks who own the assisted living facility.
When you were cross-examining her, how did you deal with that when you find out about her tragedy and her loss?
So I can tell you exactly, because I will never forget this as long as I live. She was blubbering on the stand, and rightfully so. I mean, she literally was losing it. And I sat patiently and just let her cry. And when she started breathing again, because she was crying that kind of cry where she couldn't get her breath, you know. And when she started breathing again, I said, and she was still crying, I stood up and I said, Your Honor, may I get the witness a tissue? And he gets his gavel and slams it down and says, the bailiff will take care of that. And of course, I just sat back down. I think in that moment, it wasn't a lawyer for a plaintiff trying to cross-examine in, you know, some legal way a defendant in a case, the owner of a home who had killed her, whose son had killed Linda's son. It was just two people that had a common connection, and that connection was just pain. And so I responded just in a human way, and all the lawyer stuff was not even in the picture. It was just one human seeing another human going through an ordeal and suffering and doing what any of us would do if we weren't in a courtroom. And if you walked by a woman who was in that much pain, you'd offer her a tissue, wouldn't you? That's all I did. I just responded out of a place of, I believe, human connection.
It's very apparent that you're caring, not just for your client, but caring even about the defendant that you're cross-examining, is so clear. Do you have a connection in your life? Is there something that you draw on or that resonates with you in working on a case like that?
Yeah, I do, as a matter of fact. I think about what could have been in my life. I was told the stories, but never more than that. My mother had a son before me, and he lived only a short time, maybe 6 weeks, and died. And I was told that he was buried in a cemetery, and I never saw his grave, and I never had another brother. I have a younger sister, and she's my only other sibling. And so I think about when I relate, when I hear people's stories, I try to imagine what my life would have been like had I had a brother or a twin brother, for example, and or even not a twin, my younger sister, and someone had taken her from us. Yeah, I connect on that level. I try to put myself as much in the shoes of the people I'm representing and the people I'm questioning as I can.
That sounds so scary and frankly painful. Is it?
Yeah. To answer the question simply, yes, it is scary and painful. And both of those feelings you've just pointed out are welcome companions to me in trial. If I don't feel fear, if I don't feel pain, I need to go find something else to do with my life besides be a lawyer and be a trial lawyer. I need those things. I need to feel that because I would be robotic if I didn't feel those things.
What was your proudest moment as a trial lawyer?
In a short response to that, Scott, I'd have to tell you my proudest moment was representing a young woman whose cause I knew to my core was righteous. I was fortunate to be asked to try the case as co-counsel of Jamie Lee Jones versus Halliburton KBR. And we did not win that case for Jamie, but that didn't diminish how proud I was to stand in that courtroom as her lawyer, because to my bones, I believe that woman was raped and was wronged and should have gotten justice. So I was proud to stand up for her and fight that fight. That's probably my proudest moment in a courtroom, was just starting that Jamie Lee Jones trial, standing next to that girl, standing next to that young girl. I believe to my core, Scott, that most lawyers, particularly lawyers who do plaintiffs' personal injury work and criminal defense work, go into the law because they want to do right and they want to make a difference. And that's what I felt I was doing by representing Jamie. I was taking on a righteous case and trying to make a difference. So the win or the loss was not the measuring stick of how proud I was, because it was more about doing the right thing for the right reasons for me. So that's why I was so proud to be Jamie's lawyer.
But that loss, meaning that Jamie walked out of that courtroom ultimately with nothing, that must have been painful.
It was devastating, mostly for her, mostly for Jamie, less so for her lawyers.
But Ron, but I want to know how you felt. Obviously, and
yeah,
maybe that's the wrong
no,
word.
I'm going to answer that. She put all of her trust in us. And so that's why I need to give you that. I asked Jamie to sit through 2 days of deposition testimony while the defense lawyers cross-examined her for 2 days. She was on the stand during her trial for nearly 4 days. And every time she would get in terrible spots, she would look over to me at counsel table. And all I could offer her was, just stay with your feelings, Jamie. And I did that by putting my hand over my heart. And she would look at me and she would keep on going. And to feel as though I couldn't deliver justice or help justice be delivered to Jamie was crushing to me. It was devastating to me, because beyond any doubt, I know she was raped, drugged and raped. And when she was over in Iraq, she had been there less than 3 days. They slipped her a Mickey and they raped her. And I know that and I believe it, and I'll go to my grave believing that. And so, yes, it was devastating to hear the jury come back and turn Jamie away and turn her down. It was crushing.
And how did you deal with that?
I talked with the people around me who I cared about the most, and they kept reassuring me that there was not a thing we could have done better than what we did, that we gave Jamie every chance at justice, and that, you know, even with that, you can't guarantee a victory. So I took comfort in the knowledge that I really couldn't think of another thing I could have done differently.
Ron, I want to thank you for being a phenomenal fighter for people, for standing up for those who don't have anyone to stand up for them, for being a phenomenal teacher and helping lawyers for the people around the country, and for the wonderful work that you do. And I want to thank you for taking the time to chat with us.
You're welcome, Scott. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us today for Trial Lawyer Talk. If you like the show, I'd really appreciate it if you could give us a good review on iTunes, and I'd love to get your feedback. You can reach me at www.scottglovsky.com. That's scottglovsky.com. And I'd love to hear your feedback. You can also check out the book that I published called Fighting Health Insurance Denials, A Primer for Lawyers. That's on Amazon. I put the book together based on 20 years of suing health insurance companies for denying medical care to people, and it provides a general outline of how to fight health insurance denials. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you in the next episode.